Good morning. And the next proceeding on the oral calendar is State of Minnesota versus Soyan Mohammed Rashid Abdurrahman, our file number A181296. And good morning to both counsel. And as you're well, you each have an opportunity for up to 15 minutes for the oral comments, and the appellant may have an additional 5 minutes if you wish. We do ask that you identify your name when you approach the podium. There is a button there if you need to move it up or down. I know if I was standing there, it's got to go down usually so that I can see over it. And as soon as appellate counsel is ready to proceed, you may.
Morning. May it please the court, my name is Max Keller, M-A-X-K-E-L-L-E-R. I represent the appellant in this case, Soyan Abdurrahman. I should say, it's nice to see you, Judge Sleater, not in Olivia. It's nice to see the rest of you.
That is indeed God's country, though, and we're on the record, so I've noted that.
Right.
We may have some disagreement up
here. It's a lovely place. In this case, for the purposes of this appeal, basically, the facts are undisputed, and we have a recorded statement that was made by the complainant to Detective Kunow, and we highlighted that, for example, on page 6 of our brief, and the detective says to the complainant, Ms. Henry says, did he ever ask you directly to do anything to him? You're shaking your head, no. And the complainant says, oh, no. The detective says, the recorder doesn't pick that up. And you're shaking your head. He says, so he never directly asked you that, but he did ask if you guys could hang out. And the complainant says, which I immediately assumed, since he was asking that, he meant it like. And then she stops there. Now, obviously, she was saying that she assumed that he was talking about some sexual contact, but that's what she assumed. The problem that I have with this whole case, the way it was tried, is that the detectives, they were told by a third party, which is like the complainant's sort of stepfather. They were told that by the stepfather that the complainant said that the defendant appellant said such and such. And they go and they testify and they say, well, the appellant said such and such. Well, the appellant didn't say it to them, so it's double and triple hearsay. And the only thing that really matters is what the complainant actually said to the jury, not what everybody thinks that she said at some other time.
So Henry testified that your client asked her if she had ever given head, would she give him head, would she ever give him head? And I'm talking about the sexual connotation, of course. The jury heard that.
That's correct, Your Honor.
How do you argue that her impressions of what he was asking for were not for sex?
Well, I think you can...
Pretty explicit to me.
Well, it's explicit in that it's talking about sexual conduct, but I don't think merely talking with sexual conduct, merely talking about sexual conduct is a crime according to the terms of the statute.
Well, she testified also that your client asked if she ever effed a black guy.
Right, and to me, that's what I call asking about sexual history. And to me, asking about sexual history is not sufficient under the statute. But those comments or those statements that Your Honor is referencing, that is what she said that the complainant said. But the state argued at trial that the defendant appellant said a lot more than that. Because in their brief, they're saying, well, when she said assumed, that is referring to something else. But we're saying that assumed is referring to the question that the detective asked, like on our brief on page 6, when it says, did he ever ask you directly to do anything to him? You're shaking your head no. And so there's no doubt, according to her testimony, if you believe her testimony, which you must for the purposes of this appeal, we must assume that the jury credited her testimony, that she said exactly what you just said, Judge Werke. And our position is that that is not sufficient. The court may have a different view of it. I would say the case law that's cited by the state gives an extremely expansive view of the statute, so expansive that it's an extremely broad view of the statute. The state's brief on page 7 is citing McGrath, and they said in the McGrath case, the defendant appellant bumped into a person's hip while pointing at the defendant's genitals and talking about that he had hair, or he did not have hair on his testicles at that age. And when he was 14, he used to engage in these sexual acts 5 times in 10 minutes, and talking about the size of his testicles when he was 16. And this was found by the Court of Appeals to be sufficient to be solicitation. Now, I would say in such a broad reading of the statute, it's so broad and all-encompassing that it would make the statute unconstitutional, basically. So we're not sitting here saying that the statute is unconstitutional in this case, but since the state is citing that case, I'm asserting that that interpretation of the statute is not correct. And if that's the way the statute would be interpreted, it's unconstitutional, it's unduly broad and vague, and it encompasses protected speech. Now, what the state said about the facts in this case is they said that on page 8 of their brief, they said we're disregarding the complainant and Detective Kunau's testimony that when she was asked the question, did he ever ask you to do anything directly, it was supposedly made in response to a question about, quote, fucking a black guy. And says here that basically the state's interpretation of this is that the defendant appellant never asked the complainant to fuck him. And it's not exactly what she said. What she actually said is that she didn't remember. And it says basically we're asking the Court of Appeals to disregard her testimony that she was asked if she will or will ever give him head. And seems like what she really said is, I don't remember exactly what he said, which is kind of a problem when she goes up there and testifies to the jury that, well, I don't remember exactly what he said. And to me, like I was saying before, one of the problems that I have is the way this evidence was presented to the jury, because we were arguing that the testimony of the detectives is admitted as a prior consistent statement, and it's not really consistent because the detective testified that the complainant clearly said that the defendant appellant clearly said, like, will you engage in a sexual act with me? And that's not what the complainant testified to when she testified in front of the jury. So we have a double and a triple hearsay with the detectives going up there saying at some point, not when we took the recorded statement from her, but at another point, she told us that the defendant appellant said this, and, well, we can't even say if that's really what she said because there's no recorded statement at that time. And then when she does make a recorded statement, she says something that's different from what they say that she said earlier, and then when she testifies to something different from what's in her recorded statement.
Your argument to us is that the testimony was markedly different rather than not being verbatim on point. I guess that's what I'm extrapolating, because it's more or less similar, but you're just saying that there's a marked difference between the testimony?
Well, of course, if she just supposedly told the officer that he wore a blue sweater, and they came in and said, oh, she said she was wearing a blue sweater, and then there was a recorded statement that she said a red sweater, and then she testified to a purple sweater, those are all kind of collateral facts. We wouldn't waste your time arguing about that. So, yes, the answer to your question is yes, Judge Werke, we think that there's a material difference. And just to illustrate the triple hearsay, basically, for instance, on transcript page 76, they asked Detective Kunow, they said...
Why do you call it triple hearsay? Both of those individuals were present in court to be cross-examined, weren't they?
Yes, but the problem is sort of like, it's not a confrontation clause problem, which is sort of implicit in your question. The problem is getting a proper record of what was actually said. So the question that's asked of Detective Kunow on line 20 on transcript page 76, it says, was what he told you, and they're talking about what Cody said, which is sort of like her stepfather, that's the he. The question says, was what he, meaning Cody, told you, which is Detective Kunow, that Natalie told him consistent with what she told you? You see, there's triple hearsay there. So a much better way of doing it is just, you just call the complainant to the stand, you say, what did the person say? You don't need all these other people to testify and say, well, she said that too. And they say, well, technically, under the rules of evidence, yes, you can have those people testify if it's a prior consistent statement. The only problem is it's not a prior consistent statement, because it makes a big difference to the jury. Did he actually say, will you commit a sexual act with me? Now, this court might find that that's not needed to violate the terms of the statute. I think it is, but you may find different. But that would make a really big difference to the jury if the evidence is that he directly said, will you commit this sexual act with me? Or if he just said, like, well, have you ever done this in the past, or would you ever do it in the future? That is a materially different statement to ask somebody. So we do have a problem with the admission of the supposedly prior consistent statement, because to us it's not a consistent statement, and it's a materially inconsistent inconsistency, basically. and to us, basically, the complainant is saying that she didn't just say she's not really sure what happened or she can't remember. Like on page 8 of our brief, she was asked, and she explicitly said that he never explicitly propositioned her or asked her to commit a sexual act. So to us, it does not meet the terms of the statute, the elements of the statute, 609.352, subdivision 1A.
Mr. Keller, were you the trial defense counsel as well?
I was not.
I'm assuming that, you may not know the answer to this, but looking at the transcript, you probably did. I'm assuming that these are points that also defense counsel had an opportunity to cross-examine, whether it was the officer or the stepfather, and even the victim, I should say, if there's discrepancies. So really it boils down to a credibility determination the jury did make as to what happened, obviously, and they found in favor of the state.
Well, I appreciate what you're saying, Judge Sleater. Now, our position is that the jury can't credit the complainant as saying more than what she actually said. And what she actually said to the jury is, she said, she affirmatively denied that she was specifically asked for sex, and so we don't think that meets the terms of the statute. To us, that's the undisputed evidence, is that she said she was not directly asked to commit a sexual act. But there's other evidence put in front of the jury from these detectives saying, well, at a different time, not during the recorded statement, she told us something different. But one of the interesting things about this is in Detective Kunow's testimony, on when he's cross-examined, because you were asking me about the cross-examination, when he was cross-examined, then he was specifically asked, well, isn't it true that she denied that she was specifically asked to commit a sex act? And he says, no, I don't remember it that way. And then the recording is played to the detective saying, well, does this refresh your recollection? Look, this is what she actually said. On the transcript, page 88 is when the cross-examination starts. At the bottom of page 88 and the beginning of page 89, the trial attorney said, and during the recorded statement, do you recall asking her if my client specifically asked her to do anything to him? The detective says, I'm sure I did. Trial attorney says, do you recall her saying no? The detective says, I do not. Then they play the recording. So that seems pretty significant that the complainant and the detective both go up there and say, well, no, I did not deny, I did not specifically say that he did not directly solicit me. And in fact, that is her statement, that she was not directly solicited. That's what she said. That's why we make a recorded statement of these. I see my time has expired.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent, you may approach the podium.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Angela Erickson. I'm an assistant Carver County attorney, and I'm appearing on behalf of respondent, State of Minnesota. There was no error in admitting the victim's prior out-of-court statements, and the victim's testimony at trial alone was more than sufficient in order to allow the jury to find appellant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. The purpose of the solicitation statute is to prohibit any persuasive conduct by adults that might entice children to engage in sexual activity. In order to do so, it's not necessary for the offender to directly ask a child to engage in sexual contact, as is noted by the court in State versus McGrath. However, in this case, the appellant did directly ask the victim to engage in sexual contact. In reviewing this matter, the court must assume that the jury believed the state's witnesses and disbelieved any evidence to the contrary, and it must view that evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict. The court must then presume that the jury believed the victim's testimony on page 38 of the transcript, that appellant asked her, quote, would I ever give him head, end quote. And also, quote, will I ever give him head, or will I give him head, end quote. Her testimony on that matter was very clear that appellant said either one of those two things to her. Will I give him head, or will I ever give him head? That statement alone was sufficient for the jury to convict appellant of solicitation of a child. Appellant seems to be focused on the recorded statement that the victim gave to Detective Kunau, in which there was an exchange where Detective Kunau asked the victim, did he ever ask you directly to do anything to him? And the victim responded, no. Again, the court must assume for purposes of this appeal that the jury believed the prosecution witnesses and disbelieved any evidence of the contrary. And as such, the court must assume that the jury believed both the victim and Detective Kunau's testimony on page 92 and 49 of the transcript, that in that response of no, the victim was stating that the appellant never directly asked her to, quote, fuck him. That was the explanation that both the victim and Detective Kunau gave for what they understood that he was responding to. There was previously a discussion on the recording where Detective Kunau was asking the victim about these statements of, would I ever give him head, had I ever given head, and he was asking about those statements. Then Detective Kunau moved on to, did he ever ask you anything else? And the victim stated, he asked if I had ever fucked a black guy before, or whatever, F a black guy. And Detective Kunau proceeded to ask, did he ever directly ask you to do anything to him? And that's when she responded, no. It's clear in that exchange that she was referring to the defendant never directly asking her to, quote, F him. That doesn't take away from the fact that she testified very clearly that the defendant had asked her if will I ever give him head or will I give him head. Even if appellant hadn't expressly asked her directly to perform a sex act on him, the fact that he wanted to engage in sexual activity with her is readily and easily apparent from his conduct. Solicitation is a crime of a secret and obscure and hidden nature, as the court noted in McGrath, and it need not take place in any particular form of words. There is no requirement that an offender directly ask a child to engage in sexual conduct in order to meet the definition of the statute. I think that's clear in the definition of the statute, which includes an attempt to persuade. If you look at the context of the conversation in this matter between the victim and the appellant, these are two individuals that were completely unknown to each other. This 22-year-old man walked up to a 13-year-old child, had a very brief exchange in which he asked her what her name was, told her his name, asked her how old she was, told her that he was 17, and then immediately began asking her about sex acts.
Ms. Erickson, may I inquire, would you agree that all those statements the deputy gave had to be prior consistent statements in order to be presented to the jury? And secondly, if they had been excluded, do you believe the victim's statements alone would have been sufficient under the statute?
I do believe that it would be necessary for them to be prior consistent statements in order to be admissible as a hearsay exception. However, I do believe that they were prior consistent statements. Additionally, I believe that the victim's testimony in court alone would be sufficient for the jury to find the defendant appellant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And I think that one line alone of would I ever give him head, will I give him or ever give him head, or will I give him head is sufficient for the jury to find a solicitation charge on appellant beyond a reasonable doubt. With regards to whether or not the statements were prior consistent statements, I would note that this issue was raised in a motion in limine prior to the trial commencing, and on page 3 of the transcript, it was discussed in court, and all parties agreed that the manner in which this evidence would be presented was that after the victim testified, the state would proceed with calling its witnesses and introducing those prior consistent statements, and that if appellant's counsel had an objection, he would raise those at that time. I think it's fair to assume, based on the fact that there were no objections, that either appellant's counsel agreed that they were prior consistent statements, or that it was a trial strategy in which he wanted those statements admitted for some purpose of trial strategy. I would note that the defendant's or appellant's counsel did separately introduce some of the prior consistent statements that the state did not elicit. So I do believe that there is a good argument that this was a matter of trial strategy. But I would look at directly comparison of the prior statements along with the victim's testimony. The statements that are being complained of by appellant are on page 55. Mr. Stott stated, some guy just asked me to give him head or asked to give me head or asked me to give him head while pointing at the appellant. On page 38, the victim testified. He asked, would I ever give him head? And I don't remember if he said, will I give him head or ever give him head? These statements are reasonably consistent. They do not have to be the exact same wording, but the overall message of both of those statements are that the appellant asked her if she would give him head. Additionally, the statement by Detective Kunow was that, quote, then the male asked Natalie if she had ever given head or wanted or would give him head. He also asked some other questions about if she had ever fucked a black guy before or would fuck a black guy, end quote. Detective Kunow went on to say, quote, Natalie explained to me that this male had also asked if she wanted to hang out after court, end quote. On page 38, the victim said, quote, he was asking me some personal questions, like have I ever given head before, would I ever give head, would I ever give him head. She went on to say, Then he asked me if I ever, in his words, fucked a black guy. He asked me if we were ever able to hang out. Again, those statements are reasonably consistent. The only portion of those two statements that's not almost exactly identical is the portion of where Natalie had stated, or would fuck a black guy. However, on page 90 of the transcript, appellant's attorney was the person that introduced the victim's prior statement that, quote, he asked me if I ever fucked a black guy or if I would ever fuck a black guy, end quote. Your Honor, I would also argue that if the admission of the victim's prior statement was in plain error, it did not affect his substantial rights. I would note that it's important that appellant bears the heavy burden of showing that any error was prejudicial and affected the outcome of the case. And appellant has simply not met that burden in this case. What I understand the argument to be is that he is saying that simply that statement of, did he ever directly ask you to do anything to him, and the response of no, should override all the other testimony in this matter. However, that is not the correct standard. The court needs to take into consideration the other testimony and assume that the jury believed that portion of the testimony, specifically Natalie's testimony and the testimony about her prior statements. If the court has no other questions, I believe I would reserve my time.
I believe not. Thank you.
Thank you.
And counsel for appellant, if you wish to respond, you may.
Just a couple of things that I wanted to say, Your Honors. The comment was made here, as in the state's brief, that this court in McGrath said that solicitation is something that's done in secret or covertly, and that's why you have to have an expansive reading of the statute, and that allegedly you don't need a direct solicitation, a direct asking, will you commit a sexual act with me? And the problem is, in the circumstances of this case, it shows that that's not, McGrath's statement is not exactly correct, because here we have a case where someone was supposedly solicited in a courthouse, and the deputies can be standing right over there, some other attorneys can be standing right over there, someone's parents can be buried back there. So we know that a conversation happened between them, because that's what everyone testified to. It's undisputed that they were together. There was a conversation in the hallway, and that's on the video. There's no audio on the video, unfortunately, so that doesn't tell us about the actual content of the conversation, which is the heart of the whole matter. And so basically, when you have a source like McGrath saying that, well, these are these things that take place in secret and covertly, and so we have to have a broad reading of the statute, but you have a case where someone is actually talking to someone, arguably in public. There's people all around there in a courthouse. So to us, it really does make a difference then to say that, these exact words do make a difference. And the problem is, when you come here as a defendant appellant with a conviction, of course, the standard review is such that the appellate court is supposed to believe that the jury resolved all factual disputes in the light most favorable to the conviction. But the problem is that the jury in this case listens to the complainant's testimony, and they could decide to believe it or not believe it. That's their choice. You don't second guess those things, but part of them choosing to believe it inferentially, they chose to believe it because they voted a conviction, is because there's this allegedly prior consistent statements being testified to, which are wrong. They shouldn't have been admitted, and it's plain error, and it's to the prejudice of the appellant's fundamental rights. And that testimony is bolstering what the complainant said. So we don't know if the jury would have actually believed the complainant if you take out this extraneous stuff that should not have been testified to. That's one of the problems. It's fine to say that we assume that the jury believed all the state's evidence. If it was in contradiction to the defense evidence, if they voted a conviction, but then the question is why? Because if you erroneously admitted evidence that may have caused them to believe the complainant, to tip the scales in favor of believing the complainant when they wouldn't have otherwise. So we'd ask that you find that these prior consistent statements should not have been admitted, that it is plain error and it is a fundamental right that's been violated, and that it was not harmless error. And we'd ask that you find that the testimony is not sufficient to convict the appellant, and therefore that the conviction should be reversed. And because it would be based on insufficient evidence, that retrial should be barred under the Double Jeopardy Clause. Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel for your statements today and your briefing. We'll take the matter under advisement, issue a ruling. You both have a good day, and we'll be adjourning now as we proceed to our non-oral calendar. Thank you.